you ever loved me, don't rob me of my hate. It's all I have.
Let it go, Edmund. Let it go. I don't know what dark plan lies within you. Nor do I know by what design we were asked to live without each other these 16 years. But God has offered us a new beginning. God. Don't slap his hand away.
Hello, listening people.
Hello.
Hello, Bartek. How are you doing?
Good, son. I mean, Ryan, how are you?
I'm doing well, father. I mean, daddy. I mean, Bartek.
It's Count Bartek.
County.
County.
County out, as John Oliver in The Lion King 2019 would say. County out.
County out.
instead of count me out. Great voice actor.
Sire! Oh God,
today we are here to talk about movies on Spit and Polish Presents because we are two men of Polish varieties that sit in front of some microphones and talk about movies. And no, we are not talking about the animated remake of an animated film. We're not talking about Lion King starring everyone's favorite actor, John Oliver, where he has such great line deliveries as "Sire!" and "County out" instead of "Count me out." Fuck Rowan Atkinson for trying to be a good voice actor in the first version of Lion King. He should have. You know what Rowan Atkinson failed to do that John Oliver succeeded in, which is stuttering over your lines. See, Rowan Atkinson is known for having a stammer, so he works really hard to not have that impact the work. Hence, he has a very specific way of enunciating things that work for comedic effect. But John Oliver, who does not have a stutter or speech impediment, he brought that to The Lion King. And that's what was really missing, was slurring lines and stumbling over them.
It was really rude of him to have to make the editors have to fix it.
It was really rude of him, Rowan Atkinson, this is, for being able to sing. How dare he? Could he not be like Seth Rogen? And just not. But we are not here to talk about the corporate policies of Disney. Oh, wait, yes, we are. I will bring that up in a moment.
Well, it's Touchstone Pictures.
Put a pin in that. But we are here to talk about a movie that has come recommended from our dear good friend Bartek. Bartek, what movie did you pitch our way?
Wait, why did I recommend a movie? Are we doing some sort of podcast where we do that?
Yes, yes.
Called Pictures Powwow?
The original PP.
Yeah, okay.
And on the original PP, we have a cycle of recommendation. You go 1 week, I go the one after that, and then the listening people, that's right, you out there listening, can recommend movies, and you will get that after my recommendation. But it is on Bartek's shoulders, and what did you give us?
I gived us a film from 2002, which, when we started this podcast, that was like the magic year. I think the first two films we did was from 2002. And now we're back to 2002 again. It's a thingy where you read it backwards and it's the same thing.
That's correct.
Like Hannah and Race Car.
And each year that passes, it gets further and further away and you feel old because you remember 2002.
When we started this podcast, it's like, 13 years ago. Now it's 22 years ago.
That's correct. How sad. And tragic even. Could you say tragic?
Sadgic.
Let's just say 2001 may have been a sadder year because Zoolander got a negative review from Roger Ebert.
Yeah, okay, you're right.
But what did you recommend from 2002?
Yes, enough delays. We are doing The Count of Monte Cristo from 2002.
I do not know why, but I always like John Oliver saying county out instead of count me out. I always muddle up the Count of Monte Cristo and want to say
County Monte Cristo?
No, yeah. Like I want to say instead of the Count of Monte Cristo, I want to say like with a D in there somewhere. I just want to throw a D, like D-E. Monte Cristo. Like, I don't know why. I always just skip over
It feels like you should be talking with an accent that's not your own while saying it.
Yes, but
Count of Monte Cristo.
We are talking about the 2002 film adaptation of The Count of Monte Cristo, which stars Jim Jesus Christ Caviezel, Guy Pearce, and Luis Guzman shows up in a startling role, and a Polish actress is here as well.
That's true. I saw that name. I'm like, wow, Polish.
I heard that accent, saw that name, and I saw that hair color and complexion, and I said, that's a Polish lady.
I've met someone named Dagmara once.
Yeah? Yeah? Tell us more.
It was one of my cousin's friends.
Were they nice?
It was. I think I remember so. We're still Facebook friends.
Would they wait more than a month for their fiancé's news of their death to then marry on? Would they wait longer than a month, or are they like the one in this movie and they wouldn't even wait a month before they move on from their deceased partner?
I didn't know them that well.
You should have by the look in their eyes. Did they have a piece of string attached to their finger?
I don't think so.
Well, no then. They would have stayed steadfast and loyal.
You know what? I think I actually found a photo not too long ago of myself, my cousin, and two of her friends, and I think she was one of them.
Well,
and I looked at her like, where the hell? What is this photo?
It's you in an Indian food restaurant in Poland drinking some carbonated water. The Count of Monte Cristo, everyone. This is a fabled story, a tale as tried and true as ever, to say, hey, if you want to listen to us talk about this movie, be aware of spoilers. Feels like it shouldn't be needed, but in case you have not familiarized yourself with this story, we recommend that you give it a look over yourself. This film is different from the book, as is always the case.
Yeah, I read some stuff.
And the original book was written by Alexandre Dumas, who also did The Three Musketeers.
Mm-hmm.
Notably also a black man writer. So people, you know, that's an interesting little tidbit. And the Count of Monte Cristo book actually deals with and goes into extreme detail about the different races and ethnicity of characters and how that plays into the socio-political game at play in the story and how it's harder for some people than others. It's actually an interesting little wrinkle that none of the adaptations outside of one kind of deals with.
And so, to be clear, you've read the book?
I've read the book.
Okay.
But everyone, make sure to check out the 2002 version of The Count of Monte Cristo. We are going to get into details. And let's get into some of our details more about the familiarity with the story, the adaptation, anything relating to The Count of Monte Cristo. You recommended this, so how about you tell us a bit about your experiences with this?
Yep. So I mentioned at the end of last week's episode that one of the big reasons why I pushed for doing it at this point is because we're going to be watching a sort of like adaptation, interesting, flippy version of it soon. But even outside of that, like I've been aware of The Count of Monte Cristo as a thing for a while, but I've never actually known what it was about. Mm. All I knew was that it's some sort of like iconic revenge story and has some sort of chateau in it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, both of those things ended up being true.
It is very much the case. Now, I have read the book, but not for like in a very, very long time ago, maybe when I was like 12 years old, 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I remembered thoroughly enjoying it. It's just one of those where it feels so perfunctory to say this, but it is as well written as you think it is. Like it is as deserving of being something cherished and heralded as a piece of literature worth checking out. Sometimes that can be overwhelming when you look at like literary classics.
Mm.
Is Frankenstein, is Dracula, is Moby Dick, like, you know, on and on it goes. Are they as good as history says they are? Not even pop culture, just history, just society, just cultures at large. And that was one in which I just fell into reading it. There was a period of time where I read, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, and Christmas Carol, and I read this, and I really remembered enjoying this. Now, a lot of the details are a bit foggy for me, but I have seen some adaptations of this. There's like a Gerard Depardieu miniseries, which has a very hilarious sequence in which he must go undercover by putting on a false nose, which is hilarious because he is famously known for already having a huge nose. So that's a little bit of fun. And an anime adaptation of the story, which Bartek is referring to in his history of things and in terms of the relation to The Count of Monte Cristo. We are hopefully going to be visiting this anime version of The Count of Monte Cristo, which is different. It's set in like sci-fi future land, France, and the perspective, main character perspective is a character that's very briefly in the book and very briefly in this movie.
Yeah, it's Albert, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Albert or Albert, depending which actor you're talking to in this movie.
Well, we'll find out what the Japanese call
of,
it.
Of course, in their thick Japanese accents.
Aruberto.
Yes, exactly. But it's a tale, as you said, about revenge. And this film, I've never seen this film before. I was aware of it. I must admit, I mixed it up with The Man in the Iron Mask. I feel like in the early to mid 2000s, there was a lot of adaptations or a lot of retellings of these stories, like Casanova and The Man in the Iron Mask and this, and even Les Miserables with Geoffrey Rush, like where there was just like this certain look to these movies, like very polished, but just like if I showed you a still image from any of those other movies and told you before you watched The Count of Monte Cristo that this was from The Count of Monte Cristo, you would probably believe me. Like, they all have a certain vibe and aesthetic to them. I don't know why, but they just do. And there was just like this obsession in the early to mid 2000s, maybe even late 90s, of just grabbing these old stories and just kind of making them a big affair again. Like, it happens. It comes and goes, is the case. So I've never seen this. I'm a fan of Guy Pearce and some of the other actors that show up. And I didn't really know what I was getting in for. I didn't know if this was going to be a more action-packed adventure film. I didn't know if it was going to focus on the revenge in like a huge way. I didn't really have much of an expectation going in. It has high ratings on IMDb. I mean, even critics gave it pretty good thumbs up reviews of it. But that does not always mean it's a quality film, especially if you're giving it a look all of this time later.
For myself, not too long ago, a couple of months ago, I was watching some sort of YouTube video that a couple of guys were in the video, and one of them was talking about how they really liked this film. It's like, oh yeah, the 2002 Count of Monte Cristo, Edmond Dantès, really badass character. And, you know, connecting what I heard there with like all the thoughts that I had before of like, oh, I'm going to be probably watching that anime not too long from now. I've always been curious about the story. Maybe I'll do that version since, you know, I'm getting such a good recommendation for it.
And what did you feel about this, being someone who hasn't consumed the source material, hasn't really encountered it done in other forms, had a loose understanding of what you were getting in for, but how did you feel about this film?
Overall, I really enjoyed it. It was a really good ride. It looked very nice. Again, not being too familiar with the story, when it started and really indicated like, oh, this is from Napoleon times. I recently saw the Napoleon film. I'm like, okay, let's see how this film handles that era then. So that was a fun little comparison point. Tying back to some of the things we were talking about a couple of episodes ago when we did The Last of the Mohicans, you could really feel a lot of like Hollywoodisms in this film, which kind of soured a little bit, but overall not to, you know, a detrimental degree for myself.
I'm very much in a similar place, maybe a little bit more downbeat.
Yeah, I figured.
Again, it's been too long since I can recall all of the differences from the book, and you can't do the book in a movie easily. The first part of the book is a bunch of... The book is made up of a lot of subplots, a lot of different characters interconnecting and then eventually culminating in the count. Like, in my recollection, the first good chunk of the book is about people's meetings and interpretations of the count himself, and then the back half is dealing with the count.
Oh, is it like an in media res thing?
Yeah, I guess so. Like, it's a lot of like, oh, I'm being invited to this dinner party at this Count of Monte Cristo, and you're getting these people's perspectives, and you're wondering how is everyone connected.
Okay, that's
and
interesting.
Then you flash, and that's why the anime adaptation version takes the story from the perspective of Albert, because it's basically the same idea of like,
a character
who's this
from...
mysterious someone who's got some agenda, and then you reveal what the agenda is.
Yeah, a character from the latest part of the story. He wasn't around 15 years prior.
Yeah, exactly it. But As a film, this is perfectly fine. I feel so-so on the acting. Some of the acting is really well done, and some of the acting is middling, and some of it I just think is straight up bad. The direction, as you say, looks very nice. It's very polished. You can see the elegance and decadence put in. It's well lit, well framed. It's got some memorable sequences to it. The music is fine. It's there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story that even in its form that it is in currently with this, it's still a good story. This is a good tale, even if they've had to condense things and change things around and alter this and alter that. Even if you're not familiar with that, this is just one of those sagas about revenge and lost love and a life taken away that you can't help but be embroiled in as you go through this. So overall, I think I like this. A bit of a mixed bag at times, and I'll bring up that Disney thing. So this is a Touchstone movie.
Mm-hmm.
I already had a copy of this, but I saw Touchstone and I paused it and I went to my Disney Plus account because, you know, Touchstone, Disney, they have a lot of stuff that is from Fox and other places on mm-hmm. Disney Plus. Nope. They didn't have this movie on Disney Plus. Why would they?
I was about to say, yeah, if it was on Disney Plus, I wouldn't have had to download it.
Exactly. And it's just one of those things where it's like, why isn't it? It's a Disney product by all sense of the word. Like, Touchstone is a Disney thing. So why is it? And other Touchstone things, I don't get streaming services. They annoy me. Just put the things on there, you fucks.
Do they have Nightmare Before Christmas on there?
Probably do. I haven't double-checked. I own that physically, so I don't have to worry.
Mm.
But where do you want to begin? What do you want to talk about?
I suppose we can start with our main character. I remember when I recommended the film, you were like, ooh, Jim Caviezel, Jesus himself. And, you know, you made a big thing about that. And even after we finished recording, you told me, like, oh, you should do your homework on Jim Caviezel. You should Google him.
Mm-hmm.
I did it lightly. I don't know if I found everything you wanted me to find, but, yeah, he was in some film not too long ago.
Mm-hmm. The Sound of Freedom.
I think that was it, yeah, mm-hmm. where that film dealt with, like, I would not even talk about this film anymore. I suppose just bring it back to what you were talking about, though. I guess that film deals with
child trafficking?
Child sex trafficking or mm-hmm. trafficking in general.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept making a bunch of QAnon references to it.
Yes. Yes. He's a weird guy.
Yeah.
And it's so hilarious because he is that handsome actor guy that has been in big movies. He played Jesus.
Mm.
He's in this. Like, if you go through his career, he has been propped up or positioned to be like the handsome movie star man, but it never happened. Like, he never took off. Like, Jim Caviezel has not taken off. And now in his back half of his career of where we are now, he's entered a really interesting realm of, like, conspiracy theorist, QAnon, right wing, whatever. And whatever you think about that, the point is, I wanted to highlight Jim Caviezel is such a peculiar actor, man, because this role is like a gift to an actor. Like, here's a, like, so much stuff could be wrung Ooh. Out of this. And in my eyes, he is Jim Caviezel in terms of, yeah, he does the job, but he doesn't really rise to the occasion. He doesn't really overcome. He does the job. Like, if you said you thought he was good, I won't argue with you, but he wasn't excellent. Like, he wasn't that extra oomph. Like, imagine if Heath Ledger did this movie.
Mm.
Imagine that, like, bam, that's an instant, ooh, I could see that. Like, imagine if Christian Bale did this movie. Like, but Jim Caviezel, he's just a guy throughout his entire career, he's been there.
Yeah. Like,
always just kind of circling. But, like, do you even know Jim Caviezel's name if we didn't bring him up a lot?
So I knew the name, but I didn't know anything about him. Like, even when I thought back to Passion of the Christ, I wouldn't have been able to tell you who played Jesus. I just would have told you, like, oh, yeah, I remember Jesus in that film because of all the things that happened to Jesus in that film. And, yeah, watching this film, like, you're right. He does feel like he was built up to be handsome, you know, actor man. To the point that, like, when he's in prison for 15 years, it's like, oh, he's still looking pretty good for, you know, the whole stay there. I guess he was getting a little bit of exercise in by the end, but even before he met Dumbledore, like, you know, he was still not looking too bad.
He has better teeth than Guy Pearce, whose teeth get worse throughout the movie on purpose. But, like, why does he have better, like, because he's handsome, rogue, lead. We are going to make him, he's basically Armie Hammer before Armie Hammer. Like, there's always these handsome white guys with the square jaw and the nice hair who can act, but are they a star? Are they actually a great actor? They're fine. And both examples I brought up have revealed themselves to be very strange men who have found themselves in very strange corners of the industry.
I guess also because, you know, they're making him look pretty good throughout the entire film, there was a point where you had to wonder about the suspension of disbelief of, like, okay, which characters that knew him in the past would not recognize him in the present? Because we had a couple that weren't recognizing him. And then eventually there's the twist of, like, oh no, the one that would obviously recognize him does recognize him.
Of course. So with your thoughts on it, we went straight to, like, the actors, and because this is an actor's movie.
It is, yeah.
That's what you're here for. And I must admit, I found that to be the weakness, because I didn't think there was a unity within this cast. When you watch certain films, or most films, there's a cohesion within the cast. Like, everyone knows the rhythm that the movie needs to be, or, you know, and on the occasion you have someone who's completely in their own realm of weirdness. Like, Tim Curry's always in his own movie when he's in another, but that's a plus.
Yeah.
But, like, when you watch something like bring it to something near and dear to us, Oscar, the Sylvester Stallone movie.
I was already thinking.
Everyone is on the same page of what they are here to do. But I didn't feel that with The Count of Monte Cristo. I really felt like so many people were in their own sphere of things. Like, Guy Pearce is an actor I truly adore. I love Guy Pearce. Loathed him in this movie. Not his character, his performance. I really couldn't see past Guy Pearce, the actor, having fun or trying to really ham it up. Like, his stupid little hair piece, he has this fucking wig on his head, like fake hair. He has these stupid teeth in his mouth as the film goes. Like, I couldn't stop seeing him just really relish being like, I'm a bad guy. While other bad guys in this movie, like the prosecutor guy, although he was a little hammy, he didn't feel like he was like Guy Pearce, where there's like this knowing, I'm getting off him. I just couldn't abide by how much of the cast felt like they were in their own realm. And with Jim Caviezel, I thought he gelled the best when he was working off of Richard Harris, of course, and Luis Guzman, like those two. But like every other time he's interacting, Jim Caviezel, he's acting off of actors who I want to say aren't playing ball. Like, they're just in their own game, it feels.
I feel like I'm... While you were talking there, I was thinking about that movie we did back in Kevin Smith month, the Red State.
Yes, how Red State.
In the credits of that film, it like categorized everyone by, like, you know, sex, politics, religion, and it's like, oh yeah, they all kind of had like their categories there, and there felt like there was like a mixing of cohesions with that. It's like, maybe if we had, you know, a bit more of a supporting cast for all the sides here, like, we see that The Count of Monte Cristo has a bunch of, like, servants and stuff like that. Maybe, you know, a bit more of them, just to create a bit more of a community that he's part of.
Yeah, but I just mean, like, in terms of, like, the performances. Yeah. I just don't think Guy Pearce got what this movie was supposed to be. I don't think Jim Caviezel rose up to what this movie ought to be. Like, I think he was trying, but he just didn't. I didn't ever feel like The Count of Monte Cristo was a tortured soul.
Yeah, that was one of the big things for me there, where... Yeah, there were times where it's like, yeah, you're saying all these things about, like, you know, 15 years of built-up desire for revenge, but you are still kind of playing it like, you know, actor man kind of thing.
That's it. He has a vampiric look when he's the Count, and when you think of that, at least that's how he felt to me. I don't know if he felt the same.
He had the charm for sure.
And I couldn't also help but think of Ed Wood, the movie, in which, I forget the actor's name who played Bela Lugosi in that.
Oh, Mark.
Martin Landau, right?
Yes. 2 months ago, we had the same
where he brought this pathos to what is inherently a very silly little guy. Mm. And that's how I felt. Like, I wish we had someone like that with this, where it's just like, and you had that with Richard Harris, where Richard Harris, in his small amount of time, really gave you a wide array of things to play with. Like, he was a funny guy, a tragic guy. You felt for him. You felt so much about him. At least that's how I – that's my reaction.
I'm fully with you. You said the two names, Richard Harris and Luis Guzman. Like, they almost tried making up for what was missing. Where it's like Luis Guzman has so many little scenes where he's talking about, like, I said I was with you for life and I'm going to protect you even from yourself. It's like that line right there is complementary to what we want.
And although you may assume Luis Guzman is going to be played as a comedic relief and he has his little moments, never really is a comedic character. He feels like he's a genuine player in this story. And there's a version of it where you could probably see it from his point of view. Like, that's the thing. This story is so expansive in its scope. Like, you feel conflicted with every person involved. Like, every person has their role to play, but the Count is too busy making it a game of revenge and doesn't care about anyone else. Because that's the story. This noble, young, fresh-faced guy, the God has smiled upon him, everything's going well, he has his best friend he cares about, he has a fiance or he's just engaged, he's going to be a captain of a ship, and then all of this is taken away from him by a few jealous people, a few seedy individuals that are just bitter at the world or cowardly, and we follow him as he, this man, Edmond, as he goes to prison on this little island where he's in solitary confinement the entire time, except for once a year where he gets beaten to remind him.
Happy anniversary.
You've been here for this much time. And then he befriends a kooky prisoner in there who's trying to do an escape attempt. And they both try to get out together. Eventually, you know, Edmond gets out on his own because the other guy dies. And he realizes his life that he knew that he was going back to is completely gone. And so he transforms himself into the Count of Monte Cristo to do an elaborate revenge, even though the story is telling him revenge is not the way. He will go for it anyway because he is so lost. And it's great stuff. And I must admit that the film started to pick up for me when we went to the prison. That's when it was like, oh, okay, now we're in the story. Like, now we're here.
Yeah, we didn't do this film on the podcast, but I had to talk about it. It was that whole prison sequence with Richard Harris reminded me so much of The Highlander.
Mm.
Like, in The Highlander, there's only a brief period of that film where Sean Connery is around. And he's basically like, you know, a mentor slash friend to our main character who's like kind of teaching him the way of how to do things and like gives him a really big boost in character development. And then, you know, by the end of that chunk of the movie where he's there, he dies and he's never seen again.
Mm-hmm.
Never ever. And that was I got those exact same kind of vibes from this film when we had Richard Harris around. You know, he was giving him the training of like how to fight with the sword, the thing with the water.
Teaching him how to read, giving him the idea of economics.
Having a lot of really witty lines and comebacks. It was just really entertaining.
I loved his story too, of this priest who was a soldier and he did a heinous thing and he was so repentant that he retreated, he deserted, and then he was framed for something and because he knew about some treasure but he refused to give up the information and then he does know about the treasure and you get that recurring thing at the throughout the thing or... It comes back at least the I'm a priest, not a saint. And
yeah, he gives him the movie one-liner.
Yes, yes. And the I'm a count, not a saint. The movie lives firmly in the strengths of the story once it gets to the revenge part of it. When you're here with Edmond and his friend and all of that, I must admit, and again, it heightens when Guy Pearce is here, but the writing is so on the nose.
Mm.
It's so ham-fisted. It's so just pronounced to me. They're telling you. Like, every scene with Guy Pearce is them telling, even if there's no dialogue. It's just he's so overtly scummy.
Yeah, especially once Mercedes enters.
That's it. And he's just... He's just a cartoon character in this one.
I told you we wouldn't always be the same way, Edmund. Edmond.
And then the accent work. Man, no one could decide on an accent, huh? Guy Pearce is like, I'll be Australian. Oh, and English too, I guess. And
the same thing.
For Jim Caviezel's like, I'll be posh American. Richard Harris is being British, of course. Like
that's like a staple of all American adaptations of like French things. Like, look at the Les Misérables.
Of course,
where the only person doing a French accent was Sacha Baron Cohen.
Of course, I still haven't seen that version because I didn't really want to. So
it's entertaining enough.
It's got Russell Crowe.
It's musical year, Ryan.
It's Russell Crowe. Russell Crowe singing. Everyone loves his singing in that movie.
Well, the film starts with that, yeah.
That's what everyone likes. Everyone likes his
singing. There's a 24601.
Oh, man. So, yeah, I did scoff at the action in this movie because it would come in. It would just, it's almost like it knocked on the door and said, hello, it's been a while since you've seen me and I'm here now. And I just shrugged and went, I guess so. I guess we'll have a little bit of swashbuckling in here. Knock, knock, hello, it's me. Did you know that I'm here? I was here at the beginning of the movie. Remember me? Action. Action set pieces.
Yeah, whenever it happened, it was also always really brief. Like when we had the scene with the smugglers, like you fight him to the death, and you had a lot of good back and forth lines. It feels like that fight was over in like 15 seconds.
It feels obligatory.
Yeah.
When, to my eye, and this is just talking about the film, it looked like it enjoyed itself when it was people at dinner tables talking about things when not, but they're not actually saying the things that they mean, like double talk.
Yeah.
When Albert enters the movie, that again really elevates the stuff. You're like, oh, I wish we could have seen more of this, where he's manipulating the son's trust to get at the dad. Like that. That's a story. Isn't that right, Japan? Yeah. Like, that's a story you could tell.
Another film that I kept thinking of, especially in the latter half where we had The Count of Monte Cristo, was the last third of Om Shanti Om.
Oh, yeah.
Where that also is kind of a Count of Monte Cristo story by the end, where, like, the current main character is the reincarnation of the first half of the film's character who wants revenge, and, you know, he's, like, getting close to the antagonist of the film, leading him into all these like gaslighty situations. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that final sequence, he's like basically putting him in a horror film.
Yeah.
And I remember in that episode, I was even saying something along the lines of like, man, I could imagine something like a film from this character's perspective. And we kind of get that in this film whenever we do have a scene focusing on, you know, the characters that need to get revenge on.
Yes, of course. To give some more positive stuff here. The cinematography was really good. Like, this is a crisp image. This is a colorful image. But when it needs to be grimy, when it needs to be dark and brooding, it does that. I think my favorite sequence from a filmmaking standpoint, from that cinematography, is Edmond's escape from the prison when he's in the body bag and they're swinging him and he's trying to grab the keys from the jailer, from the warden. And I loved how all that played out and them falling into the sea and him drowning that guy and swimming off. I thought that was just really well done.
Yeah,
like, it's
great.
A nighttime scene. You can see the stuff that you need to see and the other things are just drowned out in darkness. It was tense. It was thrilling. It got my blood pumping. I had that... just raw primal feel of a viewer where once we were revealed how he was escaping, I was like, fuck yeah, that's great. Yes.
And you got to have a little bit of a bonus with the warden having like these very like cartoony evil lines like, God, I'm so bored.
Yes. Oh God, I have all the time in the world.
I don't have all the time in the world. Oh, actually, yes, I do.
Scum. He, that actor, was in an adaptation of The Three Musketeers. Just to talk about Dumas a little bit. So that's a fun thing. He was in a 90s adaptation. So that's a bit of an interesting wrinkle where he's been in two, at least, adaptations of Dumas' story. So that's something.
When I was reading up trivia about this film afterwards, I was reading a trivia point that like mentioned character names and in brackets, like the actors that played them. And I was thrown off by the guy that played the smuggler, J.B. Blunk. That's a voice actor that I've heard in a fair number of games. Like,
Me too.
I didn't realize he did live action stuff.
Of course. I've mentioned this before, but he's in Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. He plays a minor character, but an important one, which is he's a doctor to Gus Fring. The major kingpin villain of the show. He's his secret doctor that he has hidden away. And I mentioned this in a spare time, but I watched an animated show that's worth checking out, Arcane, which is the anime adaptation or like such and such of League of Legends. But I have no familiar, but it's a good show. And he does a voice in that. And I'm like, who's this sexy voice? He has the sexiest voice. And then I found out, oh, it's the dopey little doctor from Breaking Bad. And then I realized he's been a million voice things, as like voice acting things. But I know him. My entry point is from live action work. I'm like, hey, it's that doctor. So
it's just like your history with Robinette and Downs.
I liked his character in this too. He reminded me of so many characters like this. You see in these movies, like the scumbag pirate with a heart of gold that will help you out because
it's
you've shown your
character.
Honor or you've paid them well, and they just have a little smirk and they just chuckle to themselves as they help you do something heinous to somebody who deserves it. Just
For me, I mainly think of him as he plays the main character's uncle in Persona 4. It's like a detective character who's like firmly in the realm of reality. And he somehow does a pretty good job, even when he doesn't get into all like the supernatural elements that are at play. Really great character.
What are some other positives or things that you want to flag up about this, whether it was from the filmmaking or the storytelling? Again, this is newer to you, so tell us a bit about your journey.
In terms of, I guess, cinematography, I really like the whole spectacle of like when the Count revealed himself to people and you had like the fireworks in the background, the hot air balloon, the people on the ropes who were like doing not pole dancing, but like,
they were doing circus delays.
Circusy aerobic stuff on the ropes to put it down. It's like really good spectacle. Then comes, says hello, walks away. It's like, ooh, he's really built up a lot of intrigue in these people. I thought that was a really cool scene. In terms of other beats that they were hitting, when we had the beginning of the film, and this is kind of a point where I'm like, I wish we had a bit more of this. Beginning of the film, when they come back to, the town that they're in, we get somewhat of a sense of like, geography and what everything that's there. Eventually, when he comes back after like the 15-year break, it felt like that would have been a really good sequence to really soak in like the changes that had happened. And like, we get that a little bit with him just looking around and seeing that his first mate, former captain guy, now has a business. But I really wish, that sequence could have hit a little bit harder.
I agree. It was a camera pan up and it was just a sign with the different person's name. And the thing is, I didn't remember the first person's name. So you can't make me go, oh,
yeah,
no.
Yeah, true. I didn't either.
You can't make me go, oh, no, the old man.
Oh,
his
no.
His business is gone.
Oh, no.
He may have died. Oh, wait, no, he's alive? Okay.
Biff is the main character's father now.
Oh, that's, yeah, yes, yes. But, I completely understand that. I thought, too, that the way that the Count was introduced as like this opulent figure who bought out this land and got it from this previous person, like, he is a fucking wagon full of just jewels and gold. I love that. And Luis Guzman plays it perfectly. Like, he's not hamming it up. He just plays it as stiff and upper crusty as you can. I loved the toast to Albert, where Guy Pearce is such a weasel and planning and scheming that he can't be bothered to do it himself. His son's 16th birthday to Henry Cavill. That's Henry Cavill. That's Superman, everyone. Anyway, he was 17 when he did this movie.
Someone online pointed out, like, because, there's the twist eventually that the Count of Monte Cristo is his actual father. It's like, ooh, Jesus' son is Superman.
That's great. But I love the toast and how the Count uses that to his own advantage and gives him like this brilliantly worded little speech and thing to really feed into Albert and just to twist him and turn him and just overwhelm his emotions. And I thought Henry Cavill was fantastic in this movie. He was really good as this character that when you introduce him late in the movie, you understand like he's a plot device, he's a means to an end, like, oh yes, he's a mechanism. And you think, oh, he's just going to be a bratty kid because at first he's like, I want to go to Rome, like, ooh. But he brings a lot of needed but unexpected gravity to this pompous little boy. But at first you think he's like an airhead, just this little lilting guy. But then Henry Cavill, just there's something in his eyes, something in his voice, something in his mannerisms where I genuinely felt for this person. I was shocked. I was like, wow, okay, because, and I, you know, because he comes in so late into the movie, you kind of are content with who your players are at this point. You go, okay,
yeah,
we know who we're taking down.
All right, young guy, you don't know the full gravity of this story.
Yeah, I thought he was really good. I have no opinion on Henry Cavill as an actor. I haven't seen him in much, and what I have seen him in, he hasn't wowed me, but he hasn't made me angry either.
Took the words out of my mouth, yeah.
Like, I have no problem with him as Superman. It's just the material is not for my liking. I love him in the film Stardust, which is a great movie.
Sorry, I've only seen the Gus Fring Stardust.
Yes, another Stardust. But he's in that as like a pompous guy with a sword, so that's fun. But what else is there to say? I mean, what did you think of the actual revenge stuff when the movie started to get into that, where he gets out of prison and he reinvents himself and he's on the path of vengeance?
I do think that, yeah, Jim Caviezel needed to complement that a bit more, with a bit more like dark emotions. But in terms of actually seeing it play out, like, we had some good moments there where, you know, he's in the sauna with the guy that actually, you know, sent him to the prison. And the guy is just like unable to follow along with what he's saying until like he's arrested. And you had that scene where he's in the, you know, parallel scene where it's like, oh, now I'm the one in the cart heading to prison. And he tries to kill himself. And it's like, you really thought I'd make it that easy?
That was a great moment.
That was a great moment. And I was reading in the trivia, like apparently the original version of the scene was like, you would have the gun to be loaded so that he could kill himself. It's like, but you know, we had the line earlier in the film. It's like, death would be too easy for them. So I'm almost surprised that, you know, that wasn't the original plan of the scene.
It's more in line with the book. That's the thing. Like the original, like the shooting themselves, that's more in line with the book.
Oh, okay.
In the book, the revenge stuff does play out still very, like, literally the character is reading Machiavelli. Like, that happens in the story. Like,
yeah, there's a book of Machiavelli somewhere.
Yeah, so, yeah, Machiavellian stuff. But in, again, not to get too nerdy, but in the book...
Get nerdy.
You have the one guy that, you know, the sleazy guy that took over the shipping business. He does the, tries to steal from the Count, but then he gets caught robbing and he gets stabbed and he dies. Then you have the Guy Pearce equivalent, and he's the one that in my, because there's actually like four people, like there's three main ones, and then the prosecutor guy.
Yeah.
You have the Guy Pearce equivalent, where he basically, he kind of gets prisoned, like goes to prison, goes all that, and then he kills himself. You have another one in which it's like, the Guy Pearce is like an amalgamation of two characters. You have another one where they are a rich guy and he buys out all of his businesses and stuff like this. I may be muddling them, but there's one where he turns the guy's wife against him and makes his wife poison people.
Ooh.
And kill them all and kill the whole entire family and do all these heinous things. And then with the prosecutor guy, you know, he kind of screws with his mind and he goes crazy and things like that. So there's like, maybe mixing some of those plays around, but like there's a difference of how these people go out in comparison to this movie, where the prosecutor guy, he goes to jail, he tries to kill himself, he can't do it because they gave him a gun with no things, and then it's just, you know, Guy Pearce.
I see. So it's a bit of an adaptation issue.
Yeah, they're just... condensing it for the simplicity's sake.
You mentioned like there were four people in the book, and the film kind of tries to do that where they, when he's listing out the people, he adds his wife, or his former fiance as part of the list, which felt kind of weird. And then once he finally started having scenes with her again, you know, he kind of drops it. So it's like, oh, well, okay.
Well, she betrayed him in his eyes.
I understand why he thought that. But
thank
still.
God he twirled his hair again so that she knew it was him.
Yeah.
The thing that he never really did in the movie outside of the two moments it was shot.
I honestly was wondering, like, oh, did that happen earlier?
It did. She made a whole thing where she's like, if you keep doing that, you'll go bald. That was a lie.
Oh, that was.
When they had sex on some rocks.
Yeah, there's a sex in the cave.
When she got pregnant for having,
the conception.
Out of wedlock sex. Yeah. Conception of Albert.
Conceived the anime main character.
It's fine. Like, this movie's fine in my eyes. Like, it can be a bit corny, especially the end where they just kind of basically read out a text from the book and end the movie. I'm like, you don't have to. I know you need to say lines from books sometimes. You don't need to do it that directly sometimes.
Did you like the message of like, now that I'm finished with my revenge, I can do good stuff?
Mm-hmm. That's it. You win in the end.
I got to do the bad thing and now I can do good things.
I mean, that's kind of the book. So he goes like back to the Orient and stuff. So I guess that's kind of the book. But
the Orient. That's where Japan is. That's where Gon Kutsuo was made.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the title of the anime version is what again, sorry?
Gon Kutsuo.
Which is the name of the Count of Monte Cristo when it was first released in Japan. It was under, I can't remember, it's like the mansion or something else, some other word.
Mm.
And then eventually over time, they released it under the Count of Monte Cristo, which is basically the same, but, you know, with some Japanese words, but not all, and because, you know, not all of it translates. But everyone just calls it the original title because that's just what it was for a long time. So it's like, yes, Japan knows it's called The Count of Monte Cristo, but they're not going to call it that after a certain point.
They're going to call it Old Lady Must Disappear.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Is there much else you want to say about this movie?
Not too sure. No, I don't know. For a while, I thought that the third guy that he wanted revenge on, the first mate guy, I thought he was the guy that played the caretaker in Harry Potter, but
oh no,
I was wrong about that.
No, he just has long hair. He's balding, has long hair and nasty teeth.
And the nasty face.
Yes, yes. No, I understand. I understand. There's some interesting actors that pop up here, but
no, we only had Dumbledore.
Dumbledore was here. Yes, Richard Harris.
OG Dumbledore. This was apparently the last film released before his death, right?
I didn't realize. That's sad. He was a great actor.
There were posthumous films that came out. I think even Chamber of Secrets, but this was the last one.
His son was in Last of the Mohicans, Jared Harris. He was the British officer on the horse at the beginning of that movie. And I reference that because I'm like, oh, I love Jared Harris. And it was one of his early films. A great actor.
Was he the one like reading out the law?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they look very much alike, father and son. So Jared Harris has a bit more of a deeper voice, while Richard Harris, he has that breathy voice,
which
worked really well for Dumbledore, unlike Michael Gambon.
Did you put your name to Goblet of Fire?
Said Dumbledore calmly. So I don't have much else to say about this. It's a classic story. It's a great tale. I think it's a bit lacking in this film adaptation. It doesn't do the greatest job of adapting the story either. But if you're not going to be a nerd about that stuff, then this is still a good swashbuckling time. I think that some of the actors are missing the point and some of them just don't really have that strength as performers to get to the point. Like, again, The Count, Edmond, is a gift to an actor. This is a buffet of what you can play. A real transformation.
This is a character that transforms, yeah.
And I didn't feel that at all for Jim Caviezel. Like, I didn't really feel like he lost anything, this character. Like, I didn't feel him become a darkened individual, somebody who's been stripped of things, who's broken.
He became less naive, is the most we can probably say.
Yes, he became a swashbuckler. He knew how to use a sword by the end. I'm trying to recall a movie that we've done on this podcast that is a perfect example of like a character, like of an actor who could really capture that, like where they have this innocent character and then they really transform into something a bit more dark and disturbing. We've done hundreds of movies at this point on the pod. I'm sure there's something.
Does Om Shanti Om count?
I mean, he was really good in that, but he's, yeah, it's a bit different to say, but.
He reincarnates. Yeah, he reincarnates.
And then he does a 6-minute musical number about how you killed me in the past, which is very funny and campy. I'm sure there's something that we've done where you see that evolution and you see what was once a good person turn bad. I mean, that's Breaking Bad as a show. We mentioned Breaking Bad. You get to see Bryan Cranston turn from a Mr. Rogers, Ned Flanders type into fucking Scarface. But you don't need the benefit of TV to do that. And I just don't think this movie captures it at all. It's just
what about
Guy Pearce's teeth get sillier.
What about the villain girl in When the Bell Breaks?
Sure, that's a great example. Perfect example. What about Scott Evil in Austin Powers? He really changes.
We only did the first one, though.
Yeah, he changed a lot in that one. He learned not to talk to his dad. But that is all I have to say. What about you? Any final thoughts? And would you recommend?
I do recommend the film. Again, there is a lot of points in this film where, you know, I wanted a little bit more, but still it hit the beats well enough to be entertaining. You know, there were some fun moments, some fun lines. If nothing else, the main guy was at least charismatic as the Count. There's a lot of good supporting characters like Richard Harris. Again, just like with the Sean Connery segment of the first Highlander, really entertaining, memorable part of the film. Luis Guzman, very complimentary to not just the film itself, but like what I kind of wanted more out of the film. This is a 2-hour-ish film that, you know, you won't really get bored by. You'll
good pacing.
It's well paced. Yeah. Nothing really, what's the term for taking too long? Wears out a welcome. Doesn't wear out its welcome.
I thought of an actor, by the way, who has done the thing that we said in a film. So we did The Three Musketeers by Paul W.S. Anderson.
Yeah, the other Dumas.
And one of the villain actors in that film was
Orlando Bloom.
Mm-hmm. Who was the other one? Who was the muscle, the person that they had the sword fight against?
Oh, Mads Mikkelsen.
And what film did we see Mads Mikkelsen turn from the sweetest guy into something darker, brooding, more sad, tragic even?
The Hunt.
The Hunt. Great example.
I guess I was trying to think of a more villainous example, but yeah.
But the Count is a tragic figure, but yeah. He's more villainous. But we do see in The Hunt him become a worse person. Like,
yeah.
He contemplates bad things because he's just so bitter. But that's a great example of like an actor who can really bring. I'd actually love to see his version of the Count. Because imagine him.
Be good,
imagine
yeah.
him in that outfit at the end as the Count. Like that vampiric look. Oh, man, Mads Mikkelsen would fucking nail this role so good.
At the beginning of the film, just have him be exactly like he was at the beginning of The Hunt.
That's it. But until then, we have a recommendation from me.
Yeah.
I, of course, do recommend The Count of Monte Cristo, this movie. It's a good time. But a recommendation for the next film we will be covering on this podcast. I had a look over my list, and it's one of those times in which I'm overwhelmed by choice. Sometimes you walk in and you go, I know what I'm in the mood for. I know what I want. I know. But this is a time in which I have a little list of things that I want to cover on this podcast. And I'm just scrolling through and I just scratching my head going, man, all of these are great choices and all of them are choices I don't want. You know what I mean? It's that indecision. Yeah. But I'm choosing one of a film that is involving actors we like and is reminiscent to another film that I have complicated feelings about. We're going to talk about Bicentennial Man, starring Robin Williams, Sam Neill, and some others. And that's a movie about Robin Williams as a robot.
Yes, I've seen
it. Who slowly has to turn into a man. And it very much has, I won't give too much away, but my complicated feelings about that movie are very similar to AI, Artificial Intelligence, in which love so much.
It's a similar film.
And so much doesn't work as well. So I can't wait to revisit Bicentennial Man with my adult eyes. I probably haven't seen it in maybe like 12 years or so. Mm. It's been a very long time since I've seen it, but I have some fondness. And
yeah, my dad showed me that film. I'm going to have fun talking about that story.
And spoiler again, I always think of Sam Neill for this movie. Like, when I think of Sam Neill, I always think of Bicentennial Man. It's just one of those early movies I saw with him in it, and he just left such an impression. So I can't wait to talk about that in some more detail. So everyone, make sure to check out Bicentennial Man in the interim of time. You can find us on some social media platforms. Facebook and Twitter are the ones we primarily use. You can find us there. You just search Spit and Polish Presents, or look in the description of this episode, where you can also see our email address, which is
spitandpolished@gmail.com.
Feel free to email us and or hit us up on social media with your thoughts, opinions, questions, queries, concerns, and recommendations for films that we can talk about on the pod. We need some more film recommendations. We are getting to the bottom of the list. We're getting smaller and smaller in number, so you should help increase that number. But until next time, listening people, remember to be kind to each other, or else I'll unleash a horrific plan where I become really rich.
No, my son, I've done it before. It's not worth it.
How many times did you giggle at Luis Guzman saying the perfect advice in the movie? You're rich. Just take the money and go. You've got the girl. You got the son. Just go.
That was a really good... It feels like there were people that, you know, read the book or like are very familiar with this story, and it's like that was a line written by a lot of... you know, people that have read those stories, and it's like, come on, you've got so much there that you can just live and be happy.